Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
President Bush continues to not let facts get in the way of his ideology.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Welcome to the Above Politics Show. I'm Martin Bain, and there's a silence because Justin, as some of you may know, has moved on. He's had the opportunity to do something with an internet radio station, a five-day-a-week gig, I understand. So we've had to launch a competition to find new hosts for the show, and we've actually got two new hosts for the show, and today we're going to be meeting one of them, and in the next show we'll be meeting the second one. So we've had that competition, and thank you to all the members that did apply. It was a hard job for myself and Mr. Rabbit, who I've got to thank for all the help he gave with that one, and also the management team, who also gave me their input. And one of the other things that we're also going to instigate is some special reporters. So they'll be having segments that'll be appearing hopefully in sort of maybe every other show. Maybe a special subject, something that's of interest throughout the world. So without further ado I should really put a drum roll into this one, but I'm not going to. But our first host, the new host of the Above Politics Show with me, is Homer Fife. Homer, say hello to the wide ATS audience.
Hello, America. It's good to be here. Martin, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. We just have to broaden the audience a little bit to say not just America, but the rest of the world.
That's true. And sometimes, being the conservative American that I am, I forget there is another world out there. And I apologize, Martin. I understand that you're across the pond on that little island, England, it's called, correct?
Well, I suppose for political correctness, I probably have to say Great Britain, because otherwise I'll get loads of hate mail and UTUs from my Irish, Scottish and Welsh friends, which, you know, I don't want to upset them because, you know, we're all the same people on the same island. But
that's correct.
So presumably you sort of mentioned, therefore, have a conservative leaning, so therefore you're sort of leaning to the, is it fair to say you lean to the right of U.S. politics?
Martin, I'm not sure leaning to the right is a good way to put it. I like to refer to myself as being to the right of Rush Limbaugh.
Now, if you want to send any hate to UTUs, don't send them to me. Send them to Homer Fife, who is on our system now, so that's what you can do. So.
Yeah, I assume that I will be getting some hate mail, but it's my viewpoint, and I stand by it, and I'll defend it.
And that's all we can ask for, and that's all we want. And of course, when this show airs, you want to post comments, good, bad, indifferent, I don't mind. I'm sure Homer doesn't mind either. Find the show thread, post something, and we will reply to you. So. Anyway, I know there have been some interesting things going on in the U.S. elections, and certainly one of the things that's caught my eye over here, and I have the opportunity to talk to you, was I know with Republican Vice President Sarah Palin, she sort of expressed views on creationism, and I just wondered, talking to you, whether her views on creationism actually matter or make a difference to how people may vote.
You know, Martin, it's a shame. it really should not make a difference because, in my opinion, religion has no place in politics. However, it's going to make a difference. Basically, anything, and I'm not just – and this is not just a conservative comment. This is politics overall. Anything that any one of the political parties can find that may be a negative in someone's past or their beliefs is going to be put to the forefront. Take, for instance, creationism, what we're talking about, or views on abortion, or any one single item of one of the candidates' viewpoints. If you talk to enough people and tell them that Sarah Palin is a creationist, which she is, to me, that has no political impact whatsoever. However, you're going to have people out there that are atheists who believe in strictly in evolution, who are not going to vote for Sarah Palin because she's a creationist. She's a creationist, and that's a shame. But that's just the way it is. We've heard everything from her daughter's baby is an alien to, I mean, you name it, and we've heard it. And this is just another instance of that. But basically, a person's religion or their religious viewpoints has no business being brought up or debated in politics at all, but it will be.
And clearly, one of the things that it's certainly interesting for me looking in here, Homer, is that, you know, when you talk about the Republicans, you know, there's always a lot of thing about the, you know, conservatives stroke religious right there. And I just wonder how much of that, of, you know, Sarah Palin's views plays to that constituency, you know, and I don't know, you know, and I suspect it's a fairly large and fairly powerful constituency within the whole US electorate that, you know, that's maybe a good thing for Senator McCain to have somebody who, you know, clearly maybe identifies with that constituency, so therefore he's confident that a lot of those votes are going to come to him on election day.
Well, yes and no. I fully expected Senator McCain to choose Mitt Romney because Senator McCain is going to win the South. He always has. Even when he came into South Carolina in the last presidential election and actually insulted some of the people down here, he still won the state of South Carolina. So he's going to win the South, and the South is a huge voting bloc. But what you're saying is correct. The religious right is a huge, huge voting bloc. And, you know, Sarah Palin's going to capture that with her creationist views. And it's going to become an issue. And the Democrats, of course, are going to play it. And hey, if I was in their shoes, I'd play it too. That's what politics is all about. Find something negative and keep pounding away and try to win votes.
But I think one of the interesting things that I also see is that, you know, more and more people seem to be saying it's more about Senator Obama versus Governor Palin rather than the two presidential candidates. And I think, to me, that's extremely interesting that, you know, I think many of us were taken by surprise when Sarah Palin became the chosen running mate. And I think, you know, clearly from what you've just said here, Homer, you were fairly surprised as well.
I was shocked.
I just wonder, you know, whether there's some very, and clearly there obviously are very sharp strategists on both sides of this campaign, whether as soon as Barack Obama made it obvious that he wasn't going to potentially choose Hillary Clinton as his running mate, that, you know, someone very quickly thought, hang on a minute, can we steal a march here?
Yeah, and I think it's just natural. We're comparing the two most like individuals. If you compare Obama to McCain, it's difficult to do that because they are two diametrically opposed individuals with lifestyles that are so completely different. You've got McCain, who served his country his entire life, military. We all know about all of that. You've got Obama that's got basically a year and a half, well, besides his community organizing skills, but he basically has a year and a half as a senator in the time that he hasn't been campaigning for president. So you've got two completely different people, and now you insert Sarah Palin in, who is a relative unknown, fairly young, fairly inexperienced in the political spectrum. So she can be put up against Obama as a better example and a better comparison. But I'm going to say this, and this is just completely my opinion. I have never seen an election where people voted for a vice president. This is either going to be the very first time that that's happened, that people cast their vote because of Sarah Palin or against Sarah Palin, or it's going to follow along exactly the same as every other election, and people are going to vote for the candidates, and the vice presidents just ride the coattails in. And it's going to be interesting.
And I suppose, you know, one of the interesting things will be to see, you know, Joe Biden and Sarah Palin debating, which I think actually, I suppose looking in it quite harshly and cynically from outside, I potentially think might be a more interesting debate than the debate with the presidential candidates.
Oh, much more interesting. Much more interesting. I spent a number of years in Delaware, and Biden was my senator. And I'm here to tell you, I'm not impressed with him. I wasn't impressed with him then. His views are all over the place. I have no problem with a liberal if that person is liberal in their heart, in their mind, and in their actions. Biden isn't. Biden's a career politician who's only concerned about making decisions based on how many votes that's going to get him. Sarah Palin, on the other hand, has proven time and time again with her experience in Alaska that she is committed completely to her beliefs and her belief system, and she stands by that. So you're correct. A debate between those two individuals, fascinating.
Absolutely. And that's probably something that, you know, whilst of course we'll have to stay up and watch it all, I suspect that one might be slightly more interesting. And I suppose one of the other things that, you know, because the states is so huge, are there states, and I suspect the answer to this one is there are always states that make a difference, and I suspect, you know, California has clearly, you know, typically maybe always had a bit of an influence in, you know, how the rest of the country actually votes, but
I don't know about that, Martin. I think that California is so far radically left-wing that even the other states sit back and laugh at California simply because of their viewpoints. There are certain states, and I think what you're getting to are the swing states. Am I correct?
Yes, absolutely. You know, are there states that actually make a difference? Now, you know, if you say take California, right, does that mean you're sort of implying maybe the industrial heartland becomes much more of a factor in determining who is going to be the next president?
It does. It absolutely does. What the traditional standard is, you look at your large population areas, and they're going to be liberal / Democrat. Look at your heartland, your southern states. They're going to be good, strong conservatives and vote Republican. Then you've got your weird states. Florida is, of course, our most southern state, but it is a swing state. It could go either way, and it carries 7 electoral votes. So it's very important. Ohio, and another as you refer to it, a heartland state, a strong swing state. There's just basically, you know, when you're talking about a conservative state, you're talking about Texas and Oklahoma and Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi, and then moving north, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming. Those states always traditionally vote conservative / Republican. New York, California, Oregon, Washington, those states are all traditionally liberal / Democrat. Then you've got states that are kind of peppered all through. I just mentioned a few of them. But now Virginia carries has 13 electoral votes, and they can go either way. I'm just trying to think of some more here real quick. Michigan, Minnesota, Montana, you know, and you're talking 3 electoral votes there. But still, if you're talking about a close election, I mean, look at what happened in 2004. It not only came down to being close, but it came down to a decision with the Supreme Court on who was going to sit in the office. So these swing states are important, and issues like what we're discussing here with Sarah Palin's beliefs, her religious beliefs, they're going to factor in heavily.
And I think it's just probably worth just so that everyone sort of knows that it's not actually the people that vote that actually make the decision to elect the president, isn't it? It's all the sort of, they have representatives from each state then for the electoral college that actually cast votes. And some of them have, I believe, in the constitutions of the state that must be governed based on the sort of either a proportion of the state, or if the state majority is for a particular candidate, they vote that way. But there are some states that where potentially the people on the electoral college can potentially cast that vote differently to the way that the people of that state have voted.
And it's very necessary. There's been a lot of criticism about the electoral college, but that was put into place for a very good reason. And to me, anyway, in my opinion, that reason was never more prevalent than in the last election, and I'm sure it's going to come into play in this one. Without the Electoral College, the sitting president of the United States would without a doubt be Democratic every single time, because the large population centers in California, New York, New Jersey, places where you have the most people in the most compact area are going to vote liberal. It's just the way it is. Your farmers, your construction workers, your basic blue-collar workers who vote conservative are spread all over through the country. So the Electoral College was put in there to make it even, to make it fair, so that every state has a significant and equal impact into who sits in that office. Just to give you an example, Alabama has 9 electoral votes. That gives them a certain amount of impact in the overall Electoral College votes, and that they would not have because of sparse population. So, and it's distributed. It's distributed evenly. Montana has 3 Electoral College. I've mentioned that before. North Dakota has 3. Their population is very low, but they still should have a significant impact. The people there make a difference. Their voice should matter, and without the Electoral College, their voice wouldn't. There would be no point in going to the polls in states that have sparse population if not for the Electoral College.
Okay. Because, I mean, clearly, you know, and that's why I wanted the point brought out, because, you know, certainly in other democracies, certainly in most of Western Europe, you know, my vote is counted as my vote, and that makes the, you know, the impact on, you know, whether my local MP gets elected or not, or the candidate that I vote for gets elected. So there's no intermediate person sort of saying, well, fine, I'm going to take a look at what certainly happened there. So that's certainly interesting. One of the other things I know I'm moving, and it is related to the US elections as well, was sort of, you know, that the government bailout of AIG, and then and I know you and I spoke a little bit off air about this, so I'm still going to use the phrase toxic loans. But one of the things I think was interesting is the fact that, you know, President Bush and the two presidential candidates got together for this, you know, powwow, this sort of discussion on, you know, how to you know, bail out the financial marketplaces, and I actually see that as quite positive, that, you know, these two candidates can actually come together. You know, I mean, any other time they're trying to score points with each other, but clearly, you know, both of them are obviously have the maturity to realize there are times when they've got to step above their own personal personal game and step up, you know, what's good for the country.
Yeah, and you'd think that, but if you've been following it pretty closely, you'll notice that they've already politicized it. There's already been comments about the fact that the Democrats reached a solution prior to McCain getting involved. of course, there are currently, what I'm familiar with anyway, there are 2 recommended courses of action, and the first being the one that the president put forth of the $700 billion. And I think the current one that they're looking at now going with is the $350 billion with $100 billion in escrow and another $350 billion standing by in case it's needed. And everybody I've talked to at work, everybody I've talked to, they're freaking out over this, and they're worried about their investments, and rightfully so. This is a time in our country when we haven't seen anything like this in my lifetime. We have basically right now no credit. Loans are being denied, turned down. We've gone from one of the strongest economies, one of the strongest housing markets that we have ever seen, one of the lowest unemployment rates, to almost overnight going to people can't get a loan on a home. And something has to be done. And bailouts like this have happened before. And every single time that the government has stepped in and bailed out a large corporation, Chrysler comes to mind, the taxpayers have wound up profiting from that. So I think that the panic is a little bit premature. I really, truly do. I think that this needs to be done. You're talking about AIG, but let's go further back to the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They control something like $15 trillion in assets. If they go tits up, then the market cannot absorb that. It's just not possible. The government has to step in, or we're talking about a worldwide global calamity. We have to understand that, and we talked about this at the beginning when you corrected me when I was talking about Welcome America. We're in a global economy. This is not just our piece of the pie. this is the entire world, and we are the largest chunk of that global economy, and we have got to do that responsibly, and we have to take that responsibility seriously. And if the government needs to step in, then it needs to step in, and I just think the panic's premature.
But what about, and I certainly heard this on one of the, certainly in the UK, on one of a radio program, that some of the Republicans in the Senate and Congress were slightly unhappy at this bailout because they see it as potentially, you know, being able to reward some of the senior managers and directors of some of these companies who are maybe going to apply to the government to say, hey, you know, I've got some loans that are pretty suspect. They meet your criteria, and please buy them off me at some agreed price. And I think a lot of Americans, and I certainly think a lot of people in the UK, would have a similar view that, you know, why aren't these people being, you know, taken to task? Why aren't they being, you know, why aren't they currently languishing in prison cells, you know, waiting for, you know, serious investigation about the way that they ran their companies? There are talks that, you know, with Freddie and Fannie, that already there is some talk out of the FBI that maybe those companies haven't been run in the most professional and regulatory-minded way that they should be, yet, you know, a lot of people are still going to make a huge amount of money if they can sell these loans to the government.
Well, to say that these corporations haven't run themselves in a manner that befits their stature is an understatement. But what you're talking about, as far as protections go, people making money off of this calamity, if you really look at Bernanke and Paulson's proposal, the second proposal, the $350 billion to begin with and the $100 billion in escrow and the other $350 billion being held in reserve. If you read that, now the proposal is quite long, but you can go online and get the breakdown of it. There are protections in there that prevent the exact same type of abuse that you're talking about. Because the last thing that we want to do is people jumping in here and becoming rich because the government's throwing $700 billion just into a pot and letting people scramble around and fight over it. So if you look at the first proposal, the one that George Bush was talking about, I listened to his speech and I appreciated his speech, but I don't think it was that well thought out. I don't think that there was enough. He really should have delayed that speech until more of the specifics were ironed out. But if you really, going back to it, if you look at Bernanke and Paulson's second proposal, there are a lot of protections in there to prevent exactly the thing that you're talking about.
Okay, and then, I mean, I know the other one, you know, was to talk about AIG, and, you know, and I suppose, you know, I have to sort of think, well, why would you want to say, I mean, I can understand saving, you know, Freddie and Fannie, I can understand the logic of saving those companies because clearly the amount of money that they have, you know, held that they have, you know, and they guarantee. But AIG, I mean, I've got to say I'm more hard pressed to understand AIG, and I think their hit was maybe they guarantee around about $300 billion worth of loans. But you know, again, you have to sort of question the way those companies have been run, and are we now getting to the stage where maybe some senior managers, maybe in the US, maybe in the UK, maybe even in other European and maybe European and global countries, are going to be turning around thinking, hang on a minute, I actually may be too big to fail, so therefore, you know, maybe I can afford to take the odd risk or two because I know that a government is going to come and bail me out somewhere.
Well, you know, it's a good point, but specifically with AIG, you're talking about what is it? The $85 billion is what the bailout is for AIG. That's, you know, that. Look, I think that probably the easiest way I can say this: none of this would be near the issue it is if it wasn't election year. I really truly believe that. AIG right now, and you're talking about an $85 billion bailout because AIG affects homeowners. They affect the heartland. We've already talked about the heartland, but they affect that segment of people. They affect the people who cast votes. So what you've got now is you've got a political struggle on who can look the best on doing what they can do to make your average American voter think that they're doing something for the country. And that's what AIG is about now. And of course, now that's just my opinion, but you know, they just can't let a company or a corporation this large go completely bankrupt. And now you're talking about penalties for these people. I think that's going to come. I don't think that right now is the time to do it. I think right now what they're doing, they need to be doing. They're working on saving these corporations. They're working on bolstering the stock market. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about by the hysteria being a little bit premature. Last week, there was all of this talk about economic collapse, the stock market collapse, massive recession. I even heard the word depression mentioned a couple of times. How many points did the stock market lose in the 7-day period last week?
Far too many.
54 points.
Oh, I suppose on a week, yes, I suppose if you look where it started at the, where it started and ended at, yes, I suppose you're right actually on that scale, but I think some of the swings in the week, you're absolutely right, were quite horrendous, but you're absolutely right, maybe people do have to take more of a pragmatic view here and say, let's not just look at things on a day-by-day basis. I think that's actually a very good point there, Homer.
You have to. I owned Microsoft stock when Microsoft split up, and I held on to my stock, and as a result of that, I made money. So, and this is the same type of situation. You're going to have people that do panic selling. That happens. The minute somebody says recession, people get online, they go to their favorite site, and they start dumping their stock. Look at gold. Gold is going phenomenal because people are thinking, well, I got to buy gold because the economy is getting ready to collapse and there's going to be World War III. And, you know, so you really have to take it with a grain of salt. And I think we're going to get through this, and we're not only going to get through this, but you need to remember that in each and every single time the United States has stepped in, the United States government has stepped in and made a bailout. Granted, this is the biggest one in history, but every single time they've made money, every single time the stock market has benefited from the actions of the government. And I'm not a person that's going to tell you to trust the government 100% of the time. No, absolutely not. But look at history. Learn something from history. And all of the panic, hang on to your stock. It's still going to be worth something. And I just think that the hysteria needs to stop, and you need to take a look at the past history.
And let's face it, I suspect that the US government will make money, you know, hopefully when AIG, you know, the economy improves and, you know, AIG becomes much more a fiscally responsible organization, they will no doubt privatize it again or float their share back on the stock exchange and no doubt hopefully make a fairly significant return. And whether they'll do that, I suspect they'll also, I don't know how much money they might make out of, you know, Freddie and Fannie.
Yeah, I mean, Martin, you being in Great Britain, you've seen it. Every single nation in the world has up and down fluctuations in their economy. It just happens. That's the way the economy works. Anybody that's been alive for any period of time remembers the 70s. We went through an impression in our repression with huge, huge interest rates, inflation out of control. I remember the gas lines. And but before that, we had a long period of an economic boom. Right after that, another period of economic boom. Now we're going down, and that's, it's just a natural fluctuation. And as long as people don't panic, and I think everything's going to work out fine.
And you're just sort of talking about, you know, comments that people made. One of the things that I don't know whether this was recorded or reported in the States or not, but the Archbishop of York, fairly probably the number two religious leader of the Church of England in the United Kingdom, said that the people who had short-sold HBOS, which is a fairly large bank and mortgage company in the UK that's just agreed a deal with Lloyds TSB to be taken over, and basically people were short-selling its share, so they were basically had their shares at maybe 20, you know, £10, and they were basically betting that they'd go down to £8, and therefore, you know, manipulating things so they'd go down to £8. And I believe it's John Centimer, who's the Archbishop of York, said that these people were bank robbers, which is quite interesting. That, you know, You're right, and you know, I suppose initially you laugh, but then you think, hey, this is a very, you know, senior religious leader who's, you know, making a moral statement, which is probably the kind of thing that I suppose you want your religious leaders making. But it is interesting that, you know, even across in the UK, some of these things that have happened, you know, maybe people are starting to wake up to think, I just wonder how much of this is, you know, how many people have made money in maybe the financial areas, the financial sectors, both in the US, the UK, and across the globe, out of this, when the rest of us are potentially suffering?
Well, they're out there. People look at things in, you know, smart, economically aware people look at things as an opportunity, and you can look at it different ways. You know, people are going to make money off of this, Martin. It's going
Absolutely.
To happen. And is that a person taking advantage of an opportunity? Or is it a person, a robber, like you said, or like?
Well, I mean, I certainly think what John sent to me was saying that people had, you know, decided that HBOS was maybe a risk stock and therefore sold short. So they were deliberately trying to drive the price of the shares down so they could make money and then mm-hmm. buy them back at a lower price and make money. Maybe one of the things I'll put a request out there, maybe someone could on the show thread maybe put a nice concise definition of short selling so that we can all understand that. But I just thought it was interesting that, you know, here's a senior religious leader in the United Kingdom who sort of felt that, you know, anybody who made money out of potentially driving the price of HBOS down was seen as a bank robber and being, you know, almost probably what he's trying to say is they were being morally bankrupt.
Well, those sort of actions are extraordinarily illegal in the United States, short selling and that sort of thing. However, I'll be honest with you. If I see a chance that I can invest in one of these corporations that the government's going to bail out and I can make some money on it, I'm not going to not invest. People have to invest in these corporations, or they're not going. You have to trust the market. If you trust the market, these corporations will pull themselves out. The money will get paid back to the United States with interest, and we're right back on track.
I think that's right. Well, let us take a quick break. And when we come back from this break, we can talk a little bit about some things going on throughout the rest of the world.
Are you ready for a close encounter of the third kind? Well, so are we. Hi, everyone. Dave Rabbit here with the ATS Mix Show from AboveTopSecret.com. My partner, Johnny Anonymous, is waist-deep in reviewing over 120 hours of videotape that the ATS investigation team took over a period of 10 days while they were all at James Gilliland Sanctuary at Trout Lake, Washington, overlooking the beautiful Mount Adams. In addition to Mark Allen, also known as Springer, Stephen Melzer, also known as Cracker, Johnny Anonymous, also known as Johnny Anonymous, we had a very special VIP AboveTopSecret.com member that accompanied the team by the name of Robbie Williams. And in case you're one of the few people who live your life underneath a huge rock, Robbie Williams is the English singer-songwriter who has sold well over 100 million records and is in the United Kingdom Music Hall of Fame. Robbie and his crew join Mark, Stephen, and Johnny for a casual conversation about what each of them saw over a few days at the sanctuary. So if you want to hear the Robbie Williams UFO interview at Gilliland Ranch and see some of the amazing footage that was captured there by my partner, Johnny Anonymous, you can find this incredible conversation and video on the homepage of AboveTopSecret.com, the number one alternative to mainstream media for alternative topics.
And we're back. And one of the things that I had the opportunity to talk with a UK's correspondent for the Above Politics show, Nephemore. So I had the opportunity to talk to him about the UK conference season. So let's have a listen to that. And I'm talking with our UK special correspondent, Nephemore. And as we're in the middle of conference season in the UK, I thought I'd get our political correspondent from the UK on, and we'd have a talk about the political conference season in the UK. So, Neph, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So, I suppose one of the things is to sort of just educate educate. There's a rough word. We're going to get shot over that one. Please send the U to use to me, not to Neff. I said it. About conference season, because I suppose some people may think that they're similar to the Democratic and Republican nominating conventions, and clearly our conference season is an annual event.
Yeah, it's an excuse basically for the party faithful and all those people who want to be seen in the background on the television associated with the party to go and all get together and talk policies and leadership contests and all kinds of interesting stuff.
So we've had the Liberal conference. We've just finished the Labour Party conference, and then we've got the Conservative Party conference coming up. So one of the things was interesting about the Liberal Party conference was that the leader of the party didn't know how much the state pension in the United Kingdom was, which I think is a bit of a travesty, really.
It was a bit of a gaffe on his part, definitely, and he was quite a way out. He was from like £60 out on the overall thing, and of course the Labour Party faithful listening to him talking about it jumped on that and jumped all over him. But generally, I think he's come across really well. His party has also come across really well, and they found a bit of a star with their finance guy, who's Vince Cable, who. Really, judging by his personality, probably should be the leader, and Mr. Clegg, who is the leader, should have been doing something else.
Yes, I have heard that a lot of commentators have said that, and it'll be interesting to see whether the Liberal Party faithful decide to put the knife into yet a third leader, which would be extremely interesting.
It would be. I don't think they will. I think they'll go for a bit of stability at the moment and wait and see what happens with the upcoming by-elections and possibly even the general election. But I don't think that Mr. Clegg will get past the next election if they don't do particularly well.
And do you? And I like, you know, every sort of conference before a general election, you know, the Liberal Democrat leader always says, you know, to the faithful, go back and prepare for government, which you have to commend them for, you know, absolute positive vibes. But, you know, I think we have to be brutal here and say there's probably not a realistic chance of them becoming the next government.
Oh, no, definitely not. And he didn't say that this time. He said something along the lines of, we're ready to govern, not prepare for government. So a bit of a toning down from the rhetoric on their part.
But it is sort of, I mean, the only time you could ever see them in government could be if maybe the Labour Party, you know, don't have enough votes, or sorry, don't have enough seats, and then need the help of, say, the Liberal Democrats, which, you know, they've often talked about this power sharing, and I suppose it probably would be a discussion if we actually ended up with, you know, the two major parties not having an overall majority, but I suspect at the next general election that's not likely to happen.
No, I don't think it will. I think, personally, I think Labour's slightly doomed, and I think we'll have a backlash along the lines of the end of the Thatcher major era, where there'll be a huge swing towards the Conservative Party. But just going on from that, it would be very hard for the Liberal Democrats to make their bed with the Labour Party in light of aforementioned Mr. Cable's statement about Gordon Brown. He said, custom dictates that I should make some jokes at the Prime Minister's expense, but I have already done enough of that. I'm not a sadist. I have no wish to kick a twitching corpse. It's not exactly what you would expect from people that would be working together.
No, you have to suspect not. But at least there was some, you know, some humour and lightening of the mood. And then I suppose we do have to have a quick chat about the Labour Party conference. And I know I think there are a lot of people that may be expecting maybe a formal challenge to Gordon Brown. But I have to say, I think he's probably come out of this conference in a stronger position than when he actually went in.
He has, but that's on account of his wife, and I don't think that's on account of him. Unlike in the States, where the wife is almost an integral part of the machine of the candidate, in the UK it's slightly different, and the wife tends to stay off in the background. This time, however, Gordon Brown's wife stepped up to the plate and made a speech. And the reaction to that was more positive than I expected. And I think Gordon's sort of ridden on the coattails of that, because his follow-up speech was okay, but really it was more of the same old from the Labour Party.
And that is interesting. I know he suffered, a member of his cabinet saying they wanted to spend more time with their children, which, I think we always read we can always read a lot into that, but I suspect in this case it may well be a fair assessment. But it is interesting that, he's going to have a more major reshuffle of his government, and I heard talk that he was maybe going to take David Miliband and move him to become Chancellor, which I think would be a very interesting thing to do.
It would be, because the current Chancellor, Alistair Darling, has got all the personality of a plank of wood, and David Miliband is probably Gordon Brown's closest rival with regards to a leadership election. And it's an interesting setup, because previously you had Blair as Prime Minister and Brown as Chancellor, and now it looks as if it's going to be Brown as Prime Minister and Miliband as Chancellor, and I'm just wondering if there's a bit of history repeating itself there.
But, you have to think the last two Chancellors, probably haven't been the most live-wire and dynamic characters we have, but do you want the person that's, responsible for the fiscal policy of, Great Britain PLC to be sort of, jokey person? You probably do want someone who's probably slightly less of a live wire here.
I don't know, because in the current climate, I would take any bit of happiness or laughter that I could. So Miliband going in there and cracking a few jokes would probably lighten the situation a little bit.
It probably would, and I suspect they've had a rough time of it, and I know I've heard people sort of saying that Gordon Brown's desperately trying to distance himself from what's going on certainly in the UK economy, in the global economy, and I think it's very hard for him to sort of avoid the tag that he was Chancellor for so many years, and it's not like if you come to become Chancellor you can really be held responsible for anything that happens in the first 12 months, because you probably had no impact on that one. So I suspect his aim to try and distance himself from saying, but I'm the Prime Minister, I'm not the Chancellor anymore, doesn't really wash.
No, it doesn't. I mean, as the main architect of the Blair government that set most of the financial problems we've got in the UK up, it's a bit of a snow job, although there is another possibility that he could be trying to bury Miliband and discredit him by putting him in as Chancellor. And letting him take the flak for it, which would drop his profile within the party.
And do you have to think that he's a man that probably realises either how powerful being Chancellor can be or what a poisoned chalice it can be?
It could be, but he's not going to get much of a say in it, because if Brown seeks to appoint him and he turns it down, then the party will turn on him and say he's not supporting in difficult times. If he takes it and Brown decides to dump on him, then, in some respects, he's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. But on the other hand, if he gets into the job and works it and pulls a few rabbits out of the hat, he's strengthened his position. It's a very unique position to be in at the moment.
I mean, the only other serious candidate I've heard for being Chancellor would be Jack Straw, but I'm just not sure that... I'm not sure that he's the right man for the job.
Well, replacing one plank of wood with another plank of wood, it's not going to work. I don't think so. I think his legacy with regards to how he's handled other departments that he's been in charge of, I don't think he would fit the bill particularly. I don't think there's a lot of confidence in Jack Straw.
I suppose the only other one that maybe comes up because of her high profile would be Jackie Smith, and I wonder if we could be seeing, and I'm going to get shot down if I get this wrong, I think the first female Chancellor.
That would be interesting. That Labour could actually play on that as giving the purse strings to a woman to be prudent and look after the country in difficult times. There's certainly a political payoff in that. I don't really know enough about her credentials as to whether she would be the best person to be advising on fiscal policy, though. I don't think she's got that much of a background in it.
But then, realistically, has David Miliband?
Well, And I don't know, to be perfectly honest. I would assume so. He's had more of a dealing with the Treasury with regards to the transport roles that he's been in. So I assume that he's got more of a fiscal background in balancing budgets and allocating projects over Jackie Smith.
That's worth something. And then finally, so that we can't be accused of not being balanced here, the Conservative Party have their conference coming up, and I suspect that we're not going to see the kind of fevered press attention regarding the leader, because I suspect that David Cameron can feel fairly secure in his leadership.
It's the first time in a long time that the Conservatives have gone into a conference with a stable leader that seems to have people behind him. It will be interesting what they come up with. The rumour is that they're going to go after the current economic problems because they can lampoon Brown on that. Whether or not that's going to backfire, because it's more sensationalist politics than actual substance, it will be interesting to watch this time.
But I suppose one of the things that they can get away with is turn around, that the Labour Party can't turn around and said, but look at the mess you left us in. So I suppose, I think if I was a Conservative Party strategist, I'd say that's actually a fairly safe thing to do, because they can distance themselves from that by saying, hang on a minute, we haven't been in power for so long. You can't really blame us for anything that's gone wrong is going wrong in the economy.
They can't blame them, but I bet they'll try. That's a tried and tested Labour policy, isn't it, to attack the Tories on their previous record. I think they'll have the Conservatives will go after Gordon Brown. I think the Labour Party will fire back with accusations of trying to revert the economy back to the high unemployment figures of the Thatcher era and potential future policies and try and play it off that way. It's going to be fun to watch, to be perfectly honest.
That's all we can want, really, to make politics slightly more exciting. So hopefully what we might do is when the Conservative Party one is done, we may get you to either record a segment or get you on the show.
Oh, I'd love to come on the show. It would be fun.
It would be fun. Well, thank you very much for that one. And no doubt, listeners, we will get a back to normal service for the next show. So I'm putting you on a little bit of notice here, Nephemore, that I'll be looking for a UK political roundup for the next show.
I'm sure I can come up with something for you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And certainly, as I said in that article, we'll be getting a roundup from Nephemore, but I certainly want to thank him for having some time and having some fun talking about that. And just sort of glancing around the world, a couple of things that I certainly noticed was that I saw some statistics that said the economy in Ireland is technically in recession because it's had two quarters of negative growth. And I think what makes this one significant is that Ireland, for maybe the last 10 years, had been seen as a sort of driving economy for the EU. They always called it the Celtic economy. It was an economy that experienced a huge amount of growth. I have to say, some of that growth, I think, came off some of the infrastructure projects co-funded by the EU. But it is interesting that Ireland is now suffering, and certainly it's had a fairly big downturn in its construction marketplace.
I have a question for you. When the EU does this sort of thing and funds these projects, do you think it possibly creates an artificial expansion of an economy and thus sets up a government such as Ireland for recession?
And that's a very good point. I mean, certainly the idea behind this one was to try and make Europe more balanced in the state of the economies and the sophistication of the economies. And certainly when Ireland joined the EU, it would be fair to say that it certainly didn't have as buoyant and as powerful and maybe even as a diverse economy as it has today. I mean, typically Ireland's economy in the past was probably very much based on agriculture. It doesn't have a lot of what I would call its heavy industry. It doesn't have its own automotive industry at all. I stand to be corrected, and you know what to do, but I don't think Ireland has any indigenous automotive businesses. It may have people that do components, but it doesn't have anything like, for example, in the UK, you have, you know, Vauxhall, which is now part of GM, you know, you have Rover, you have Daimler, you have other makes in the UK, and certainly in the US, then you have, you know, Daimler Chrysler, you have Ford, and you have all these huge industries. So, and certainly Ireland today is not receiving anything like the same kind of investments that it was maybe getting 10 years ago, and a lot of that investment that is being used across Europe is now going into some of the new eastern succession states, you know, some of those states that were part of the Soviet Union. So,
and Martin, can I jump in here real quick?
Absolutely.
What this sounds like to me, and what I'm reading here now, this is a perfect example of not allowing the market to be a free market. When you come in as an organization such as the EU and you start manipulating different economies, I think this is what you can expect. I think we're going to see more of this. I think that the stronger and the larger, like the EU grows and they start manipulating different economies, you're going to start having more and more of these problems.
I mean, I think the word manipulate is one that I think a lot of Europeans may actually question, and you know, that's probably comes down to semantics. What the intentions of what the EU has done in Ireland is more infrastructure based. So it's not necessarily to promote the economy, but it's to help build new roads, new railways, and the infrastructures that countries need to expand and grow. And I would have to say, there are projects in the States where the federal government is maybe improving roads or improving communications links in some states so that those states have a better chance to maybe export not only to within the states but also globally.
Okay.
So it's just that kind of thing. And, you know, yes, and certainly from a UK perspective, the UK has typically been a net giver to the EU ever since it joined the EU.
Right.
And I do have some friends in Ireland who I talked to about this one, and they're moving.
I still think you're right when you say it's semantics, because you're talking about the EU moving in. Or let's talk about infrastructure. The EU moves into Ireland, and they start building these roads, bridges, tunnels, whatever it is that they're building. And because the EU has determined that the market in Ireland is ready for this. But if it's not and the market can't support it, then you get what you have now. You get two quarters of a downturn economy and you get a recession.
And I wouldn't disagree with that one. I suppose the only balancing I would say to you is to sort of, and I know we spoke about people not, you know, jumping just because we've had two quarters of negative growth. The Irish economy is still growing. Just
yes.
Because, you know, instead of, you know, it's so it's not like it's going from 0.1 to minus 0.1%. The economy is still growing. It's just that, you know, this recognized measure of recession. And then there's even some talk that technically the US, you know, came close to recession because it had one quarter of negative growth. Whether the next quarter will also show negative growth in that score, then the US is technically in recession. But the question is the economy shrinking from plus to minus, or is it just plus and it's going to a smaller plus? And we have to bear in mind that the Irish economy has grown significantly in the last 10 years, and they have massively benefited from the investment made by the EU. And I think you said it's like, we, you know, globally we have, you know, good times and we have not so good times. And I just think the Irish government are just suffering from the Irish economy are just suffering from a not so good time. So
yeah, Martin, I think you kind of hit it on the head there. They had two quarters of negative economic growth, but what does that mean to the average person? Nothing. Nothing at all. If the economy is strong, the average person can still buy their groceries, buy their gas, go to work. You know, and what you referenced earlier and what we talked about as far as the United States goes, we really need to, as a whole, learn to not panic because of these power words, and recession is a power word. The term recession just throws people into a panic when reality, those numbers don't affect the average person.
And I don't disagree with you. I mean, the only thing I do know of in Ireland, and I suspect is happening in the States, and I suspect, you know, has been recorded in the UK, is there are probably a greater number of companies that are letting people go. So I suppose one of the consequences of a 1-2 or, you know, even more quarters of recession is that, you know, companies are probably being much more cautious and saying, I'm not going to turn round and do anything with growth, or someone leaves, I'm not going to replace them, or maybe I've got five people in the team and I can actually do it with three people, so you're going to say I'm going to let two people go. So that, I think, is happening. Unemployment in the UK is going up. I know unemployment in Ireland is going up, and I suspect unemployment in the US is going up.
It is. It's still not anywhere near what it was a decade or two ago, but it is. It's going up, and it's just a downturn in the economy, and I think it's to be expected.
Absolutely. And then the other thing that I saw, and I've got one other thing I was just going to sort of drop in there, was there have been some fairly significant changes in the president of South Africa, which I suppose, you know, being from the United Kingdom, probably it's always part of the British Commonwealth for many years. So it's always a country that I suppose we probably pay more attention to. But it just goes to sort of show that the infighting within the ruling ANC that has led to Thabo Mbeki resigning at the sort of behest of his party, because there was some alleged political involvement in a court case against the current ANC leader Jacob Zuma. I just thought it was interesting that, you know, here's a party that can actually wield enough power to tell the president of a country that he must stand down because they no longer have confidence in him.
But I like that system. I really like that system, because what that means is you don't have any one person who's standing in there with so much power that he can't be asked to leave. I think this is a perfect example of the move toward repair that South Africa has made in the recent past. I love it. I was reading the article here, and you know, it says here that he actually retained the majority of key cabinet figures, and the only negative that I could read in the whole article is that he replaced a controversial health minister. I fail to see how the health minister is that much of an impact into his cabinet, but I think this is a good move on their part. I really do. I think that they're looking for a little bit more sound leadership, a little bit less infighting, as you put it. And I think this is a good move that's going to go a long way for South Africa.
Yeah, that's good news. And the article that Homer was referencing, which I had also read, came from the bbc.co.uk website. So if someone wants to go and check our sources, they certainly can. I mean, the only balancing thing I'd say there is that typically the major party in South Africa is the ANC, and there's and I certainly absolutely have to agree with you there, Homer, that it is good that a political party has the power and confidence to do that. When I would suspect that there's still a lot of horseplay going on in the background, and I think that, you know, because Jacob Zuma wields so much power in the ANC, and that as soon as this judge threw out his court case, I suspect Thabo Mbeki, if he had some sensible people around him, they would have said to him, you know, you're in trouble now, don't you? But, you know, it is good to see that, you know, a country that was so racked with, you know, war and terror for so many years, you know, has come out of that, a very strong nation in South Africa, and, you know, does potentially have a political system that maybe other parts of the world could well do with having a look at. I mean, could you imagine it in the States, you know, with the Republican Party saying to George Bush, maybe after he invaded Iraq, saying, guess what, George, you're out?
Yeah, that would that would be I wouldn't leave my television for several days. But I think Mbeki either saw it coming or also believes that it's the right move. You take the fact that he was invited to attend the parliamentary session and he didn't go. So he was actually encouraged to have an active role, and yet he turned it down. So maybe even he sees it as the right move.
And that's not a bad thing. Well, we're coming to the end of this show. If you have any comments on what you've heard, if you disagree with us, hey, tell us. If you agree with us, tell us again. If you want to find the show thread, please post there, or you can U2U us, and at some stage Homer will be having a email address off the back of the abovepoliticsshow.com website. That's something I have to set up for you, and that's something to look forward to there, Homer. So
I can't wait.
You can't wait. Hopefully you've enjoyed your first Above Politics show.
I haven't had this much fun since John fell off the swing and cracked his head on the rock. I've just really enjoyed myself, Martin.
I'm very pleased. So typically we've always gone out. So if you want to say goodbye to the good listeners.
Goodbye, good listeners. This is Homer Fife, and I've enjoyed my time with you and look forward to more.
And I'm Martin Bain, and we'll see you next time on the Above Politics Show.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics Show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.